Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Erica Williams, in what you witness as a North County resident, are they able to have an impact on these decades of problems that Colin Gordon writes about?
Yes and no. So I started a Red Circle in March of 2017 in direct response to what happened. Because I am a lifelong North County resident, my children are students in the Ferguson-Florissant School District, and they had to wait to start their school year 1 week, which caused some trauma and things of that nature.
They had to wait because of the protests that had broken out?
The protests that had broken out. There were safety concerns and things of that nature. There were still, you know, traffic blocking the streets and all of that. And so the school buses couldn't freely travel through the streets in the school district. And so my kids had to wait. You know, first day of school, everyone has that excitement about getting ready to go to school. Fast forward 5 years later, Ferguson-Florissant has decided this year that they are going to make all of the students from sixth grade and higher use clear backpacks. Mm-hmm. So that has become another source of trauma within the schools, dealing with lack of resources and things of that nature, instead of coming to some type of a solution to actually look at school violence. They kind of penalize the children. And one final point I'll make with just the Ferguson-Florissant School District and how that goes into this conversation, they separated the primary and the elementary school children. So pre-K through second grade is at one school. Three through five is at a different school. So at a Red Circle, we provide mentoring and tutoring to children who are dealing with trauma. They are now resource officers placed in these pre-K through two schools.
When you say resource officers, you mean police officers?
I mean police officers.
In the pre-K and kindergarten?
In the pre-K through second grade school. So it's kind of like what happened 5 years ago is almost taking us in a direction that we don't want to go. Instead of moving the community forward, it's taking it backward.
David Dwight, what goes through your head when you're hearing some of these things Erica describes?
Yeah, what Erica is describing about the experience of students of color in schools really connects back to what Colin spoke to about whether people are treated as citizens or as subjects acted upon by their governments or their education systems. And I think that's one example where students of color are seen as criminals, seen as more adult than they actually are when they're children within school districts. And it's experience that people have all across the region. I've had the experience of going to West municipalities that are mostly white in St. Louis and been seen immediately as criminal. My car broke down in one neighborhood that I was in visiting a friend and ended up needing my whole engine replaced. But when the police were called, I was seen as suspect. I ended up being on the side of the road for more than an hour as they did extensive background checks beyond what was needed for my car breaking down.
They're running you for warrants and things like that?
Oh, yeah, checking to see if I owned the car, checking all of these things, really questioning why I was even there present in this white neighborhood.
And this is after the events of Ferguson. This is in the last couple of years this happened to you.
In the last couple of years.
Colin Gordon, hearing some of these stories today, I guess, are you unpleasantly surprised to hear that things are not changing? Or
no, I mean, I'm not surprised. I mean, I think the key thing that comes out of all these stories is, you know, we have a system.
America is just as much a colonial power as England ever was. America is just as much a colonial power as France ever was. In fact, America is more so a colonial power than they, because she's a hypocritical colonial power behind it. What is 20th? What do you call second-class citizenship? Why, that's colonization. Second-class citizenship is nothing but 20th century slavery. How are you going to tell me you're a second-class citizen? They don't have second-class citizenship in any other government on this earth. They just have slaves and people who are free. Well, this country is a hypocrite. They try and make you think they set you free by calling you a second-class citizen. No, you're nothing but a 20th century slave.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Wednesday, October 23rd, 2019. So I have been told. We will be here tomorrow. Professor Gerald Horn, our book club. We will be reading Gerald Horn's biography on Paul Robeson. A retired firefighter said he'd be willing to narrate. We've had people kind of take turns doing the narration for some of our books. So if we have other folks who would like to do a little reading, that would be grand. This is a short book, so I think we should be done. 5 sessions max, maybe. So nobody will have to do a lot of reading, but narrators, if we have multiple people, that would be grand. Counter-racist yoga retreat in Florida, December 28 to January 1. The price, $730 U.S., deposit of $380, due tomorrow, October 24th. The remaining $350 is due the second week of December. Yoga, plant-based meals. We just talked about that yesterday with Dr. Lathan. Counter-racist workshops and meal workshops. 5 days, 4 nights. Starting the new year in a constructive, counter-racist manner. Eat well, use logic. Try to say that frequently. Drop an email if you have questions, need more details. It is on the blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com. That said, our broadcast for today, I included the verbiage of Minister Malcolm deliberately. I thought that was very important. We heard the segment before Minister Malcolm spoke from St. Louis Public Radio, and they were discussing the treatment of black people before, during, and after the public killing of Michael Brown Jr. in the summer of 2014. Pause, because we did just talk about epigenetics yesterday. And we even had that segment from, I think, a week ago, also on St. Louis Public Radio, where they had the black father and he was talking about being in the St. Louis area. And he went to the park and he had his son, who was 2 years old, talk about children being treated like adults and criminals. He was 2 years old and he's learning to potty train. And he took his son over to the bushes, thinking it was the discreet location so that his son could go to the bathroom, and thinking, oh, this is a victory, because his little child said, oh, I need to go potty. He's like, oh, he's getting better. Like, great. He's mastering this potty training thing. And instead of having that moment of euphoria with your child, an enforcement officer, white man, comes over and, what are you doing? Exposing your genitals in the public? Potential rapist. Get that little, criminal, not two-year-old, get that criminal out of the bushes, put his pants up, and cites him for indecent exposure, and then arrests the mother as well when she, you know, has the audacity to say something about all of this. Almost went there, but we were talking about epigenetics and how incidents of trauma can impact how your genes are expressed. We talked about with that incident, like, now, wow, what impact does that have on bowel movements, your stomach, the rest of his potty training experience? You try to go to the bathroom and your parents end up having a gun pulled on them by an enforcement official and one of them ends up being arrested. What kind of impact does that have on you long term as a child? Excuse the side note. So back to our introduction for today, and you heard Black mother talking about her child. I remember that. I remember watching that on television. In fact, I remember playing the report on the compensatory call-in that they canceled school for the first week because they had exactly what she said. They had the protests and tear gas in the street and tanks and all the rest of it. And so they canceled school and children were having nightmares and all that. Same thing. What type of epigenetic impact does that have, experiencing all that in your childhood? And this is the result of a Black child being killed. How does that impact your experience, even if you're not in Ferguson direct, even Missouri direct, if you're just watching that on television? What sort of impact does that have? Anyway, all of that to say, that segment with Minister Malcolm X, he said, you have citizens or slaves. The St. Louis Public Radio segment, they said you have citizens and you have people who are treated like subjects. That is getting better, but I don't think that's the best S word. Words are extremely important in trying to figure out what racism, white supremacy is, how it works, and why some of these things, like Michael Brown Jr.'s murder, why some of these things continue to happen. Clear backpacks and all. Why these type of things continue to happen. Our guest for today's program, his book, about some of these things and why some of these happen, and in particular, looking at policy, planning, how neighborhoods, cities, counties are zoned, planned, how school districts are formed, planned, changed, all of that. A huge impact on why things end up looking the way that they do, even why Michael Brown Jr. was killed in 2014, just looking at the history of development in the surrounding St. Louis area, particularly with regards to white supremacy racism, can tell you a lot. We will be discussing his book, and hopefully he will allow me to ask one question about a very interesting class he teaches. It's called History of American Inequality. We'll see if we can check that out as well. But the book we will chat about today, Citizen Brown, Race, Democracy, and Inequality in the St. Louis Suburbs, recently published, about much of the themes that I just discussed. He additionally writes on the history of American public policy and political economy. He is a history professor at the University of Iowa. Pleasure to have him on the program joining us live, Professor Colin Gordon. Professor Gordon, are you with us, sir?
I'm here.
Yes, sir. We can hear you.
Glad to join you.
Oh, awesome. Thank you so much for sharing a bit of your Wednesday evening. I'm sure for some of our listeners, this is their first time hearing from you. For folks who've not seen a picture of you, you are a white man. Is that correct?
That's right.
Okay. And I guess any information, like a quick tidbit that you would like to share just about who you are, the work that you do at the University of Iowa?
Yeah, I teach history at the University of Iowa. My recent research interests over the last really 15, 20 years have been tracing the origins and the consequences of racial segregation in American cities, particularly St. Louis. So I wrote a book a few years ago called Mapping Decline about the long history of racial segregation in St. Louis that went from racial zoning to restricted deed covenants to, exclusive zoning, all these different mechanisms. And then in the aftermath, after that book was published, there were a couple of events in St. Louis, the Kirkwood shootings in 2008 and the death of Michael Brown in 2014, that drew my attention to the same dynamics in the St. Louis suburbs.
Right on. We will get to some of the details in your book as we go and see what that reveals about the system of racism. I start every program with our guests. I use the term racism and the term white supremacy. I use them as synonyms. I use the same definition for both terms. The definition I use is as follows. A global system of people who classify themselves as white and are dedicated to abusing and or subjugating everyone in the known universe whom they classify as not white. Do you think such a system exists? Do you think that definition is accurate?
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's an accurate definition. It's a very broad definition. And I think, you know, what I'm most interested in, is the different ways in which that system exists, the different mechanisms, the different policies, the different assumptions that we see in different national settings or even in different cities, different states within a given nation.
Local Dr. Frances Cress-Welsing, she was a guest on our broadcast many times. She would frequently say local, national, global system of racism, white supremacy. I think a lens one can think about as we examine Citizen Brown as this is local racism, white supremacy. However, big asterisk, because the Federal Housing Administration does play a substantial role. It is mentioned quite a bit. So local, national system of racism, white supremacy. Globally, we're dealing with the same problem. I did say I was hoping to ask about your class. It's history 32 at the University of Iowa, History of American Inequality. What exactly do you teach in that class?
It's a pretty broad approach to inequality. So I teach both sort of basic economic inequality, the rise of the 1% and the growing gap between those at the bottom of income distribution and the top. But I also look at, forms of inequality based on identity, so gender inequality, racial inequality, and all of the different forms that can take. It could be an inequality in your wages. It could be an inequality in your family income. It could be an inequality in wealth, which is very much sort of implicated by housing inequality. So it is a history class, but I start, as I do in a lot of my teaching, with a current pressing problem, and then try and trace its roots.
Okay. I didn't see a link when I was looking on your page at the University of Iowa. Is there like a syllabus to see like the literature that's required to read in that course, or what you all talk about?
There's not a public version. University of Iowa uses a course management system that only enrolled students can get into.
I see. I would like to see.
Actually, fairly common now. Yeah. But that's a good idea. I can certainly post the syllabus on my own website.
Okay. Yeah, I would. If you could, I would love to check that out. I would say, and I think this is one component that's important, and I'll say why. And it comes up in your book, man. I use the word obfuscation for people paying attention to words that listen to this broadcast. I use the word obfuscation on a regular basis as a core component of how white supremacy racism operates. Obfuscating. I could use a simple one and just say that they lie, but I feel obfuscate really gets to it, because sometimes it's lying by concealing information, by making things deliberately convoluted, deliberately confusing, and then lo and behold, it pops up in Citizen Brown. You write, as redevelopment progressed, this is urban renewal programs. We'll give some of the details as we proceed. But as redevelopment progressed, it continually ran up against formal and informal institutions of discrimination and segregation. It was not easy, as the Olivet LCRA admitted in 1963 to come up with a relocation plan that will meet the federal requirements while simultaneously considering local conditions. Those working with displaced families underscore the problem. Even our experience and the frustrations of community relations work, staff of the American Friends Service Committee concluded in 1967, this is a big quote here, did not fully prepare AFSC staff workers for the webs of obfuscation that have been encountered by them and by home seekers with whom they have worked in attempts to secure housing. Prospective buyers have found salesmen who are not authorized to sell, unsold homes that are not for sale, prices that suddenly rise, GI certificates and sale contracts that get lost, routine business transactions that spin into months of delay, credit companies that find unpaid bills that were never incurred, and questionable expressions of concern by builders and sales agents that their clients not move into a neighborhood where they wouldn't be happy. And I thought that was such a great passage, and it included one of my key words, obfuscate. I feel this is important for so many reasons and such an important task, and even related to the course that you teach, the history of American inequality, because I feel one of the ways the obfuscation operates is that I didn't read in your book, and I haven't seen it yet, the evidence of this sort of thing happening, all of these efforts on a mass scale in St. Louis and across the country to keep out anybody else. In fact, James Loewen, I chuckled because James Loewen has a very similar passage in his book, Sundown Towns, and he said the same thing, that this is aggressively so against Black people, not so against any other group. And I feel like part of the obfuscation when inequality or oppression, we're talking about white supremacy, and then people add LGBTQ, poor white people, white women, anything else really, disability, when they add that as though that is comparable or somehow equivalent or even maybe analogous to racism, white supremacy, I feel that's one of the major ways of obfuscation. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I love that passage that you quoted from, which is why I included it in the book, because I think it captures a lot. I mean, the obfuscation there is, you know, it's multidimensional, because here you have this local authority, which is basically clearing an African-American community of that we had been there for generations. And they're obfuscating what they're doing to the residents of that community who are entitled under federal law to relocation assistance. They're entitled to move back into the neighborhood when it's redeveloped. All of these things are thrown to the wind. But they're also obfuscating what they're doing to the federal government. They're saying, we found these people a place to live, when often they did not much more than give them a page of classified ads or give them an application for public housing in downtown St. Louis.
I appreciate that, but in relation to when you were talking about your course, the history of American inequality, is there any history in the St. Louis area or beyond of that, what you just described in terms of deliberate efforts to keep Black people from having quality housing, quality education, free to be unharassed from enforcement officials? Is there any sort of evidence of this sort of thing happening on a wide scale, systematic measure to gay white people, white women, disabled white people, old white people, any other groups other than non-white people, in particular Black people?
No, we see discrimination based on all sorts of descriptive characteristics, but the housing discrimination faced by African Americans, you know, across the last in the urban North, you know, which is my area of expertise, across 150 years, is unparalleled in its sort of in the systematic nature of its approach, in the way in which it reshapes the demographic distribution of entire cities in ways that fundamentally shape not only the fortunes and the opportunities of those who are discriminated against, but, I would argue, went a long way to destroying the fate of the cities themselves. Housing discrimination against African Americans is an enormously destructive influence.
Absolutely, absolutely. That is important. I would ask folks to keep that in mind when that comparison is made, particularly when white people make that comparison. I generally think that is a deliberate act of racism. Before we get to your book, Citizen Brown, one other quick question. I've been asking our white guests this question for some time. There was a non-white author. He had a piece published in a major article sometime back, and he had a sentence in his report. He said that many white people are often sincerely and greatly pained by racism, but rarely are they pained enough. And I looked at the first portion of his sentence, that many white people are often sincerely and greatly pained by racism. And I said, I'm going to ask white people, just based on your experience as a white man, you've been around white people, you study racism, white supremacy. Do you think that that is a true statement based on your research, your life experience, that a substantial number of whites are often sincerely and greatly pained by racism? Do you think that's true?
Oh, wow. That's a difficult question for me to answer. I don't know if I have the expertise to answer that question. I mean, I do think that, it does identify, what Ibram Zendi's new book identifies. That is the distinction between, being what I think many people would just consider themselves, a person of good conscience, a person that does not bear ill will to others, and being explicitly anti-racist and actively anti-racist. So those are two very different things. One example that I draw out in my own research with regard to these, fragmented metropolitan and school district boundaries in outside of St. Louis is the example of a contemporary white parent who may feel that they hold no particular racial bias or animus, but nevertheless will without fail say, I bought a house here because the schools are good, without interrogating the full meaning of that statement. Because it's really, fundamentally, that act is both an exercise of white privilege and an extension and cementing of white privilege.
Wow. I guess I'll make a couple requests. The first one is super important. This is the context of white supremacy. I do not use the word white privilege on this program because I think that's another method of obfuscating. What you write about in your book is not privilege. The ability to go in and rewrite school districts and decide zoning and decide who's going to move and when they're going to move and have plans to carry this out over years, that is not privilege. That is power. Words.
No,
Hang on a second. I'll let you speak. As I said, privilege is greatly minimizing what we're talking about. What happened to Michael Brown Jr., the case of Mr. Thornton and Kirkwood that we're going to talk about, none of that is about privilege. And in my view, it's not an accurate term. So I do request that anyone who participates in this broadcast not use the word white privilege. So I will request that you not use that term on the broadcast. The second part, I have found frequently when speaking to white people, they are frequently not honest. Obfuscate that word again, obfuscate. They are not honest in talking to non-white people on topics of white supremacy, racism. So I will request if you can be as honest as possible. And sometimes this is manifest in not answering questions. I found it fascinating. The most fascinating part of your response was at the beginning. You said that you don't know if you have the expertise to respond to this question. I thought, wow, you said you are a white man. Is that correct, Professor Gordon?
That's correct.
Okay. And you study you say discrimination, in my view, it's racism, white supremacy. You've written a whole book where you have the chalk outline of Michael Brown Jr. on the cover, and you're talking about racism. You have white family members. I presume you've been around white people. You study these issues. Why would you not have some lived experience to comment in a competent manner on a question about whether or not white people are sincerely pained about racism? Why would you not have some expertise to comment on that?
I'm merely trying to make a distinction between my area of academic expertise, what I'm trained in the area of due research, and what I would say based merely on my observations of living in this world. I see those as two different things.
Okay, but the other...
I'm a fierce believer that academics claiming expertise should stay in their lanes, mm-hmm. and they should speak about that which they know. And so I'm not prepared to speculate on an academic field in which sociologists and psychologists and others are trained to draw pertinent conclusions.
Is it acceptable for me to ask how old you are, Professor Gordon?
Yeah, I'm 57 years old.
57. Okay. I don't know. As a white man who's been on the planet for nearly six decades, you have quite a bit of lived and scholarly experience, I would think, on such a subject matter. But I won't. I'm still not sure if I got an answer to the question. That is one thing that I would appreciate if you could answer the question to whether or not you think white people are sincerely or greatly pained about racism. Do you think that's true or not? Like a substantial number of white people, just based on your experience, white people that you know, your studies.
I don't think I buy the premise of the question that I'm in a position to generalize about what all or some or most people feel. It's not an object in which I have any academic expertise.
Okay. That's your response. I'll take that. That is suspicious. I said that's fascinating, but all righty. Citizen Brown, your book on operations, in my view, racism, white supremacy, locally, asterisk, nationally, in the St. Louis, Missouri area, you have the chalk outline, unless I'm looking at this incorrectly, the chalk outline from 2014, where Michael Brown Jr., after he was shot and killed, where he was in the street, and it's got kind of a, is that kind of an overlay of the American flag? Is that, am I describing it correctly?
Well, the flag is actually on the street.
On the street. Okay. And that's where
Michael Brown was shot.
Got it. Okay. But that's the chalk outline of where his body. Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Why is that on the cover of the book for Citizen Brown?
Why that photo in particular?
Yes, sir. Why that artwork? Yes, sir.
That photograph, which is taken by a Reuters news photographer, captures, I think, what is one of the central arguments of the book. I use the tattered American flag in that context as a marker for the way in which African American citizenship has been so systematically compromised in the St. Louis suburbs.
Okay. And then you start the book with the, and I guess, or I didn't know, I'll speak for myself. I didn't know anything about, you mentioned the shooting in Kirkwood with Mr. Cookie mm-hmm. Thornton. I feel like I don't live in Missouri. I think people that listen to this program know I'm in Washington State, but so I'm not in all of these areas driving around like, oh, I know where that is. No, that not at all. But I had never heard of Cookie Thornton. I suspect a lot of listeners have not either. I guess we start with who is Cookie Thornton and what happened in Kirkwood?
So Cookie Thornton was an African-American contractor who lived in Meacham Park, Missouri, which is a small unincorporated pocket next to Kirkwood, Missouri. Meacham Park was notoriously neglected by St. Louis County and by the city of Kirkwood. So Meacham Park was there long before the sort of conventional white suburbs came out into that part of the county. But when they did, they broke around Meacham Park like it was a rock in a stream. They didn't extend sewer lines into Meacham Park. They didn't expand paved roads into Meacham Park. They just went right around it and left it behind. So for almost 40 years, there was a constant on-again, off-again debate about bringing Meacham Park, annexing Meacham Park into the city of Kirkwood. But the tone of that debate was irretrievably racist, because what the city of Kirkwood wanted, and they said this quite explicitly, was they didn't want to take on the problems of Meacham Park, which was 99% African-American, except that they would like to extend their policing into Meacham Park. And of course, the residents of Meacham Park said almost exactly the opposite. That is, we would like modern services, we would like the sewer mains extended in Meacham Park, we would like to be served and respected as full citizens of this community, but we don't want just the heavy hand of the law to be all that we get. So eventually, Meacham Park and Kirkwood got together and they agreed on an annexation in 1990. And what Meacham Park, or what Kirkwood turned around and did, was they immediately filed a plan to raise about a third of Meacham Park and build a shopping mall. And so residents of Meacham Park, like Cookie Thornton, who thought and hoped that the annexation would mean that he would get more business in the Kirkwood area, would mean that he might even get a slice of this redevelopment. Instead, what happened to Cookie Thornton was he just felt the heavy hand of the new Kirkwood government, which came into Meacham Park and started fining him for stacking drywall in his driveway, for parking his truck on the street, sort of adding up all these petty municipal code violations that were City of Kirkwood municipal code, but hadn't been, of course, in Meacham Park before it was annexed. Kirkwood ended up fining Cookie Thornton well over $100,000 in these, you know, sort of $35, $40 at a time. He became a sort of chronic antagonist to the city at city council meetings. And finally, in 2008, came to a city council meeting and walked in holding a gun behind a poster and shot and killed four of the city council members and the mayor, after which he was shot. Now, in the aftermath, some residents of Meacham Park expressed, you know, regret for the violence, but also underscored that it was understandable, given the history of sort of deep racism between the two communities, that something like this was going to happen. And that it was, you know, many in community meetings in the aftermath said, in effect, you know, what are the central themes of my book? That is, we are not treated like citizens of this community. We are treated like subjects. We are treated like targets of the law and not beneficiaries in any way of state action. The Justice Department sent in a conciliation expert to try and sort of mend relationship with the two communities, and that person left with their tail between their legs a year later. You know, the lingering resentments on both sides continue to this day.
Context of white supremacy. I will say that I frequently encourage listeners, if you live in Missouri, that studying local history, I had never heard of Cookie Thornton before. If you live in Missouri, that should not be your response to who is Cookie Thornton, that I've never heard of, you know, of this person. Like, really take the time to go do some studying, do some digging. You would be amazed. And I mean, you can get a PhD in white supremacy racism, because I don't care what state you live in. Oh, yeah. They will have a treasure trough of white supremacist activity in all areas of people activity. So study, if you have offspring, study, try to get as much information as possible, learning about where you live. As I said, I had not really heard about this incident. Did Did this incident get a lot of national attention in the same way as the Michael Brown Jr. shooting?
No. And you know, partly because what followed was, I think, a little bit more muted in terms of the social protest. It was dampened down a little bit by the Justice Department. And, you know, when in the end, you know, the Justice Department didn't really have that much to say about what they thought the conditions on the ground were. Not in the way, for example, that the Department of Justice did after Mike Brown's death, you know, deliver a pretty scathing indictment of predatory and racist policing in Ferguson. But I do think that the tragedy of the Kirkwood shootings and the death of Michael Brown are, you know, on the same side of the coin. Both Michael Brown and Cookie Thornton were mistreated in the same way by their local governments.
Mm. In a variety of all areas of people activity. And that's so important with Mr. Thornton because this is black business. We do have workplace racism. She said he's thinking, hey, maybe I'll get some of the contracts with this redevelopment. And no, that doesn't happen either.
Right.
Do you have do you have some sort of background with like English or let's see, fiction writing, English? Do you have any sort of background there?
No, not really.
Okay. You use a lot of metaphors and very descriptive analogies, both in your writing and in your verbal communication. Like just when, as you were giving that response just now, when you were talking about Meacham, and you said they split around it like a rock in the stream, and the federal agent that he left with his tail between his legs when he left after the Cookie Thornton shooting. Just, I encourage listeners regularly to pay attention to metaphors, pay attention to words in particular. One of the words that I noted in your book, I am appreciative. Thank you so much to Professor Gordon for sharing a copy of his book so I could prep for the program. It was peculiar. I was reading it on Adobe Digital, which I don't normally use for ebooks. I guess I'm spoiled using Kindle and iBooks. And it has like the cool features where you can do a word count and that sort of thing, which makes it really, if you're into words and just, you know, seeing, well, what's the word usage for this particular term in a book, you can do cool things like that. And it doesn't seem like Adobe has those cool features. I would have loved to see how many times the word quarantine was used in your book, Citizen Brown. Why did you use the term quarantine so frequently in describing what was happening in the St. Louis area?
As I looked at the pattern of municipal incorporation and annexation that left behind communities like Meacham Park, it was really the sort of best term that I could use, because it wasn't just a matter of not extending services and not including some people as part of the newly created community, but it was actively barring those citizens off from full citizenship. So when these surrounding subdivisions surround Meacham Park and eventually leave it as this little pocket of unincorporated land, it's not just that the sewer lines don't go through and the streets don't go through and the water lines don't go through, but the surrounding communities in the area right next to Meacham Park zone that land industrial so that they create a buffer between their residential districts and those of Meacham Park. And that, to me, struck me, you know, as more powerful than simple exclusion, that it was actually a sort of act of quarantine.
Number one, you just said more powerful. You didn't say more privileged. And that's the exact point that I make, that no aspect of, you know, any area of people activity, whether we're talking about Ferguson or beyond, this is not privilege. That greatly obfuscates, minimizes what we are talking about, which is white supremacy, terrorism, power to abuse and terrorize people. I looked at the definition for the term quarantine, particularly in comparison, paired with what you just said, but the definition for quarantine, a state, period, or place of isolation in which people or animals that have arrived from elsewhere or been exposed to infectious or contagious disease are placed. And the sentence they give, many animals die in quarantine. I thought that was so important. Even if you go down to the second definition as a verb, they still include animals. I thought that was so important. But there is, with the word quarantine, that is a medical term, as I understand it. With the word quarantine, that implies that it's not just that we're isolating these people or, you know, storing them, warehousing them. It implies that there's something wrong, that these people might actually have some sort of disease or contagion, that we are doing this really for the greater good. Because if they get out, you know, oh my goodness, this could infect the rest of us, right? Doesn't that have the connotation with the word quarantine?
Yeah, and that's, I mean, another, that's another sense in which I mean it. I mean, the, so I do a lot of work with, in my previous work and some current work, looking at race-restrictive deed covenants and the language that they use. And what's interesting, and this runs through both of my books on St. Louis, is the way in which African-American occupancy of residential properties is treated, you know, by white citizens, by developers, by the law, as a form of blight, as a form of disease, that's something to be eradicated. And so in the race restrictive deed covenants in St. Louis, there's typically two clauses. And these are restrictions that might be on an entire subdivision or just on one side of a street. They can be of any kind of scale. But the two clauses are, you cannot in your property have a junk shop, a white lead factory, a candle factory, you know, anything that is going to like be a nuisance in the neighborhood. A slaughterhouse is another restriction. And then the second clause is, you shall not allow your house, sell your house, or allow it to be occupied by a Negro or Negroes. Equating quite directly in such a document African-American occupancy of a residence with a nuisance or noxious use of the same place.
A slaughterhouse, animals, once again. I appreciate all of those details. And I mean, that's so common. I think that detail is important, which is why I thought his board, book, Citizen Brown, was important when I saw it, because when we have language that minimizes white supremacy racism, like white privilege, and or language that suggests that white people are ignorant about racism. Now, if it's in the covenant, and this is not just the St. Louis thing, because they have detailed maps, and we've had guests on the program, Washington State, where I am, North Carolina, which is three time zones away, all over the land, James Lawrence book, all over the land, they've got this sort of thing. Sometimes it's no niggers, sometimes it's no niggers, sometimes it's no colored people, but aggressively no black people. Sometimes it might not be in the covenant, but it's understood. You had, even if it's Nat King Cole, you had better not allow that black person here. If that's the case, and that's been the case for generations, you can't exactly then come back and say that white people are ignorant about racism, white supremacy. They are not. You cannot be ignorant if it's in the covenant, like, hey, be very clear, we practice white supremacy, racism, no Negroes here. Just, I think that's so important because that's so common in the way that we talk about white supremacy, racism, that this is an accident or this is happenstance, this is chance, or we don't know how this happened. And I think it's very important. This is designed. This is not, this is in the, we had plans that it was supposed to be this way years, decades ago. Am I being inaccurate, Professor Gordon?
No. I think I would say exactly the same thing. Yeah, it's absolutely systematic.
Context of white supremacy. Our list, particularly our listeners in the Missouri area, if you all have questions for Professor Gordon, you should dial in, ask away. We've been talking about his book, Citizen Brown. The number is 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 If you have a question, I'll get in two, and then I'll get our listeners. I guess first question, I thought, again, this was so important, and words, the use of words, that's why I harp on that all the time. Words are critical. So you're right. This is page 82. Let's see. Federal policy now gave local government broad discretion. That is another key word I use all the time on this program. Discretion. You should beware anytime discretion, if that comes up as a part of school policy, if that comes up as a part of legal policy on your job, discretion, that basically means broad latitude to practice racism. You don't have to do the same thing every time. You can use your imagination. Broad latitude to practice racism. That's what you should think when the word discretion comes up as a part of policy. But federal policy now gave local government broad discretion in both identifying blighted neighborhoods and determining the public purpose served by their redevelopment. Both concepts proved remarkably elastic, purposely so. A blighted property, originally envisioned as a tenement breeding vice and disease, quarantine, could now be a Tony shopping mall lacking a Nordstrom's. And any efforts to eradicate blight could now be considered a public purpose, a concept that under the urban renewal program slipped from meaning actual public use to the more nebulous public benefit. Just that little shift from public use. Now we're out at public benefit, which gives even more discretion to gobble up Black property and boot them anywhere but here and do what we want with this property. Can you talk about, because this comes up repeatedly in your book, Discretion to Change School Districts, Discretion to Change Zoning. Can you talk about this repeatedly and how it's every time, always, no exception, to the detriment of Black residents?
Yeah, and I mean, those are good examples that you chose. I mean, on the urban renewal front, the discretion is, especially damaging in the middle years of the last century, because the federal government was giving these local authorities millions and billions of dollars to exercise this discretion. You know, there was no realistic federal oversight. And so they basically allowed, the people who were responsible for racist real estate institutions at the local level in the first place to make the decision with federal money, and the federal money went to buying up the land that was deemed blighted. In St. Louis County, their land development authority met for the first time in 1957. I have the minutes of this meeting to decide, now that they could, have access to this federal money, what are we going to redevelop? And they identified seven locations in St. Louis County that they thought were ripe for redevelopment. And those were the seven pockets of African-American occupancy in the county. One of which was Meacham Park. The other area, I think, in which you see, this discretion starkly on display is in policing. So I'm working right now on a class action suit brought by a St. Louis law firm on behalf of people who were caught up in Ferguson's predatory policing. And in the course of that case, we got access to, in discovery, to the emails of the Ferguson city government. And what's remarkable there, and this goes to your point about discretion, is we know that the police were going out and actively identifying particularly young Black men for this predatory state action, for fining them for, doing not much more than, having one foot off the sidewalk kind of thing. And the reason these municipalities were doing this was part out of sort of rank racism, but also partly because they had no other stable sources of revenue, because property values were falling and sales taxes were falling, and et cetera. But when white citizens were caught up in this web, you know, red light cameras and that sort of thing. All they had to do was email City Hall and say, hey, I got a ticket. Can you make it go away? Gone. And so the discretion in this sort of predatory policing to decide who gets targeted in the first place and who, when they got caught up in the web, has to pay the fine, it's, you know, it's really quite clear what sort of assumptions are at work.
What, man, I read the DOJ report. It keeps getting referenced, that report that was on St. Louis Public Radio where the black father was with his child and they ended up arresting his child, or arresting the parent, indecent exposure and all that. They referenced the DOJ report because they said the white officer, arresting officer, that he was mentioned or referenced specifically in the DOJ report on three different occasions where he had a long history of terrorizing black citizens in Missouri citizens. But I remember about the emails and whites being, I think Mary Ann Twitty, she was the court clerk. I might be forgetting. She was the court clerk. Oh, yeah, Miss Twitty, can you, you know, hook that up? I was going a little too fast, and she would take care of the ticket. And then also it was the racist emails. That was a part of it. She was making racist jokes about President Obama. That's another one. I point that out and say you can't be ignorant about racism if you're sending racist jokes about the president as a coon and a nigger and an ape and all the rest of it. And then you fix the white people's ticket and then aggressively target the black people. Who is ignorant about racism? Nobody in St. Louis. Do you remember the racist jokes part of that as well? That was with the okay. That as well. You are a white person. I guess this would be a moment of honesty. Have you ever been around any whites who were telling racist jokes about black people, non-white people?
I'm sure I have. I can't think of any particular instances.
Oh, that is so common. We have had so many whites on the program, and we'll ask them, have you heard a racist joke? And we literally, like, literally, Professor Gordon, I've had a white person on this program who said, oh, yeah, I've heard 1,000 racist jokes. They were older, like over 55. I said, oh, yeah, I've heard over 1,000 racist jokes. People told them all the time when I was growing up, blah, 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 but I can't remember. That is almost verbatim, like 90. It is very, very rare. I can think of maybe one white guest that we've had on the program who said, oh, yeah, I've heard some racist jokes, and this is one I remember. Boop, they could check. That's one of the times we talk about obfuscating and white people not being honest when talking about racism. I feel racist jokes. That is one of the few times they are being honest in their views on black people, non-white people. I implore non-white people, if you want to study racism, unpack, study, look at Mary Ann Twitty. Go back and see the email she was sending about black people and President Obama. That right there will give you a lot of information about what white people think about black people, what it means to be classified as white. Can you be a white person and be ignorant about racism? Let's see. Person that dialed, person that dialed in. Oh, this is Thomas in New York. Oh, wait a minute. We'll get, since we have people out, global system of white supremacy racism, B in Toronto. You should be with us. B in Toronto, did you have a question for Professor Colin Gordon?
Yes, Gus. Thank you so much. And thank you, Professor Gordon, for also being on the show. I do have a question for you. I am calling from Canada. And laws depriving Black citizens of housing and other necessities of life in Canada here has been largely influenced by the American government. So I have this question for you. I noticed in Chapter 4, it's entitled Arresting Citizenship, Segregation, Austerity, and Predatory Policing. And you've just mentioned that for the policing, the predatory policing in part was due to lowered rates or lowered funding coming into the city. So they were focusing on young Black males for profit. So, and I like to look at patterns here. Would you consider your book a predatory reinterpretation of the Black experience within white terrorism and power? And would you foresee it as being for profit as well on the Black experience?
Sorry, you mean my book is profiting from the Black experience?
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
Myself personally am profiting from the Black experience?
That's correct.
I don't receive any revenues from the sale of this book.
So who receives revenue from this book?
As is typical in academic publishing, particularly when the production of the book is made more extensive by the inclusion of maps and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
My university actually paid the University of Chicago Press what's called a subvention.
Mm-hmm.
And any proceeds from the sale of the book go to the University of Chicago Press.
Would be a white institution, correct?
I am not in a position to characterize the University of Chicago Press.
I see. I'm obfuscating once again. Thank you very much for allowing me to ask that question, Gus. I leave the line.
Yes, ma'am. I'll ask a quick one before I get Thomas in New York. Professor Gordon, do you get any paid speaking engagements as a result of this book, Citizen Brown, or anticipate getting any paid speaking engagements for the book?
I think I've done 5 or 6 speaking engagements so far. I think I was paid for 2 of them. I just did a large community meeting in St. Louis at my own expense. So it's sort of a wash. Most typically, I'll just get my travel expenses paid.
Okay. Thomas, in New York, you should be with us, sir. Did you have a question?
Good evening to the guests. Good evening, Gus. Good evening to all the callers. Being Toronto. Man, I would say, Gus, it takes quite a bit of power, quite a few vases to keep people that they want to police from having sewer pipes and water pipes, you know? But questions Gus asked you, were you deeply pained, were white people deeply pained by racism? And you said that you're not an expert and you couldn't answer that question. Are you deeply pained by racism, sir?
Yes, that's why I do this research.
Absolutely. Would you say your parents were?
No.
Okay. Would you say your parents were racist?
No.
Okay. Have you ever practiced racism against a black person?
Not to my knowledge.
Have you ever witnessed another white person practice racism against a black person?
Yes.
Can you tell us what that was? Or at least one of the times?
I'm trying to think of the most recent one. When I was in St. Louis on my last trip, which was only a couple of weeks ago, there was an older white woman yelling at a parking lot attendant, and eventually she used the N-word. It's just an example.
Okay. Because you're in school, have you ever experienced any young white people practicing racism?
You mean in the classes that I teach?
On campus, in the classes, in your general partaking around the school district or grounds?
I would say I've not personally witnessed anything in my own classes. I have secondhand knowledge of incidents in other people's classes.
Because every week I'm seeing, it looks like more and more racism on college grounds and in high schools and I just thought that you being a professor, you can give us a little bit of insight. But what are some of the things that you hear going on in other people's classes?
I mean, a wide variety of things. You know, some of it directed against African Americans, some of it on my campus directed against foreign students more generally. Some of it directed against Latinx students.
What's been directed at African Americans? And that'll be my last question, Doug.
I had a colleague teaching a class on social policy, and you know, it was what I would characterize as a sort of you know, what's often called a microaggression, where you know, students every time the topic of social assistance or welfare came up, my colleague noticed that students would turn and sort of look at the African American students in the class, not in necessarily an accusing way, but in the assumption that they knew something about it that the other students didn't.
Interesting. *61 for other folks if you have a question you would like to ask Professor Colleen Gordon. I will look out for folks as we proceed with the text. With given the financial arrangement of the book that you shared with Be in Toronto, who was your intended audience for this text?
Well, it's written, I mean, academic publishing, sometimes the audience is quite specialized. So you might write mostly for other academics to try and, you know, convince them of your interpretation or reinterpretation of events. Some academic books, and I would include mine in this category, aim for a larger public audience. So it's, you know, it's not a long book. It's designed to be perhaps used in college courses. I know it has a broader community audience in St. Louis and in Missouri itself. So that's the audience I had in mind.
And you're at the University of Iowa. What exactly drew your attention to St. Louis? Because you've studied on this area quite a bit. What drew your attention to the area? You said, was it the Kirkwood shooting in 2008?
No, that was when my first book on St. Louis came out. Mm-hmm. I first went to St. Louis in the early 2000s, and I was going to an academic conference on a completely different topic, only to discover when I got there that the conference was not in St. Louis. It was in Clayton, Missouri, which is outside the city, but likes to sort of bill itself as St. Louis's downtown, because that's where many of the office buildings are now. And I was sort of struck by this and thought that I had some spare time at the conference and decided to walk into the city of St. Louis, which is not very far. And by accident, I walked in along what locals call the Del Mar Divide, which is the hard dividing line between mostly white South St. Louis and overwhelmingly black North St. Louis. And it's a stark boundary of segregation where the housing stock on both sides of the streets is very similar, built at the same time, same size houses, that sort of thing. But on one side of the street, those houses are worth $60,000, and on the other side, they're worth $360,000. On one side of the street, the schools are closing. On another side of the street, they're opening up. You know, they're putting in charter schools. They're lavishing resources. And I was so struck by this contrast that I decided to research it further.
Okay. That is fascinating. I think that pattern exists in other parts of the world under the system of racism. I did want to make sure that I added in. I think the term microaggression, because you used that before, microaggression, discrimination, white privilege, all of these are terms that I recommend non-white people not using, really anybody who is serious, sincere about replacing white supremacy with justice, not use, because all of that is obfuscation. All of that is being very dishonest with terms and minimizing the criminality of whites and how they terrorize and abuse black people. I go back. They called Bill Cosby a sexual terrorist. What we have described here today is terrorist systematic, and I mean government sanctioned terrorism in every way. We had Beryl Satter on the program to talk about Family Property, her book in Chicago, where it's the exact same thing. And she has a chapter in her book, one of the early chapters, a noose around the neck of black Chicagoans. And I asked her directly when she was on the program, white woman, is this terrorism? What they were doing with housing is the exact same thing described in this book. And she said, absolutely, that's terrorism, economic terrorism. Absolutely. I'll ask you the same question with what we've talked about here. Oh, your area is blighted, and equating, because you said that in the book, where invariably blighted becomes equated with Negro quarantine. Is this terrorism? Is that an accurate labeling of what you describe in the book?
I think sometimes it's terrorism, sometimes it isn't. I mean,
which times terrorism would it not be? Which times, which incidents from the book that you describe, whether it's school, policing, the housing, which components would not be terrorism?
I take seriously the meaning of words.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that I'm reluctant to use as broad a term as terrorism to characterize every piece of this story. I do think, and I take your point, and I think I agree with it, that I would call it part of the system of white supremacy. I would certainly call it a pattern of racism. Much of that racism, as we know from American history, is backed by the threat of violence. And so in that sense, yes, it's terrorist in its implications, it's terrorist in its organization, it's terrorist in its approach. But I think that is not the same as saying that all of this is terrorism.
I understand all of that. And again, I go back to what I said, answering the questions, which components, if you're that certain, no ambiguity, not all of this is terrorism. So which components do you think, this component right here, I don't think this is terrorism. Maybe it's racism, but I don't think this is terrorism right here.
I don't, as you know, from reading the book, I don't describe things in that way. I'm not, my expertise does not lie in theorizing about broad social systems and attaching names to them. This book is a meticulous blow-by-blow account of the systems that lie behind systematic racism. My feeling is when you use a term like systematic racism, when you use a term like institutional racism, it's important to understand the systems and it's important to understand the institutions. And that's all I've tried to do.
Well, systematic racism is not even used in the book. I don't like Adobe Digital Editions, but it at least can do that. That word is not even used in the book. And that was why I pointed out, because you do use terms like discrimination. You use the, one of my words that is high on my list of disregard. These should not be used. Race relations. Oh, man. Maybe you can't pick out a component of this that you don't think qualifies as terrorism, but I mean, talk about minimizing the term race relations, which is in the book and used in a robust manner. That is not an accurate description for this or any component of white supremacy racism. I've said that for years. That makes it sound as though, you know, maybe you've got two neighbors that are having a quarrel about their fence or something, or some semblance of a balanced dispute or conflict. And that's not what this is at all. This is a total power imbalance, white domination. That's what we're talking about, not race relations. And did not get an answer to the question. That is important. Retired firefighter in Florida, volunteered for some of our narration. Did you have a question for Professor Gordon? You should be with us.
Yes, sir. Evening to the guests. My question is, under the global system of racism, white supremacy, should non-white people who are victims of racism trust any white person when they speak on the global system of racism, white supremacy? Hello?
I don't know how to respond to that. Are you saying that I'm dishonest, that I should not be trusted, that I should not have told this story?
I'm saying, in general, white people practice racism. Non-white people don't have a master list on who are the white people who are practicing racism. It is possible that you could be a practitioner of racism, white supremacy. So you can either state, well, no, they shouldn't, or articulate on it in some kind of way that as far as giving me an answer to the question. Under a system where the victims do not have the power to determine on who are the racists, should those victims trust any white person?
That's not really for me to say.
Should we trust you?
I've written a book based on my research in St. Louis. You're welcome to read the book and agree with it or disagree with it. Like all academic work, the work is thoroughly documented in footnotes and endnotes. I think the proper way to go about this dialogue is to read the work and assess it for yourself. It's not a matter of trust.
Did you have another question, retired firefighter, or did he answer your question?
He kind of like avoided the question more so than answered the question. When people are with a subject matter such as this one, there is a possibility that a person like the guest could be speaking on something because he likes attention. And certainly, the guest gets a lot of attention, or gets attention enough to get employed, get compensation for what he says.
Excuse me, do you have another question, or?
No, I don't have another question because he really didn't answer it. Thank you.
Okay. Let's see. Henry, previously mentioned, Henry in Chicago. Did you have a question for Professor Gordon? You should be with us.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
All right. Greetings, Gus. Greetings to all the callers and listeners, and greetings to Professor Gordon. It's interesting, the topic of obfuscation. One question, Professor Gordon, are you familiar with Attorney Alton Maddox?
Sorry, say the name again.
Alton Maddox. Are you familiar with him?
No.
Okay. He's a black lawyer in New York. One of the things that he had mentioned or said about how white people practice racism, they use four elements. They use violence, they use money, they use and they use the law. I'm sorry, that's three elements. But you tend to use the word, I haven't read your book, but you tend to use the word policy a lot. And, you know, just like what Gus was saying about privilege, you know, I think, you know, for me, I've noticed law being a more powerful weapon than policy. Can you explain, you know, that? Am I wrong about that? Or is it something that also a word that is being obfuscated of what white people are actually doing?
I think as I use them, the words have different meanings. But in terms of the way in which you frame the question, they probably have the same implication. I mean, the law can be understood as the sort of, the set of rules that we operate under, like the constitution of a state. Policy is, you know, in my line of work, generally understood as the way in which those laws are put into action. So you may have in your constitution a law that says that the state of Iowa or Illinois or Minnesota is responsible for the general welfare. And that then is enacted by policies which might distribute housing assistance or that sort of thing. And so to me, law and policy mean different things. Policy, in effect, is the law in action.
Well, when enforcement officials are used, isn't that considered law?
Yeah. So what I'm talking about, when I'm talking about policy, I'm generally talking about things like, the drawing of municipal boundaries, the drawing of school district boundaries. You can have, with education, for example, you can have policy that affects how schools are funded, or you can have policies within schools that affect how schools are disciplined. Law is also, in this kind of work, often used as shorthand for law enforcement. But that's not the meaning that the way in which I use it. I almost always use policing when I'm talking about law enforcement in order to make that distinction.
And did I miss, because you said something about you were also working on a class action case. Are you a lawyer?
I am not.
Okay. All right, because I thought I heard you earlier about you were working on the class action case, but you're not working in a lawyer capacity, right?
No, I'm working as an expert witness.
Okay, all right. Okay, that's all I had, Gus.
Ooh, man. Expert witness, man. Let's see. The caller at... Caller last four digits 7656 7656. Did you have a question for Professor Gordon?
Hi, good evening. Thank you so much for taking my call. I hope everyone's having the best evening they can have.
Nope.
Professor Gordon, hope you're having the best evening you can have. I have a couple of questions. You stated that you were not able to define terrorism in your book. Well, I'm going to just go by a general definition. I think something, I don't know if we can all agree with it, but I'll go with Merriam-Webster. I think that's a pretty objective standard. Do you agree before I keep going?
Sorry, the connection's not good. I didn't hear what you said.
Merriam-Webster.
There is some distortion in your line. Like, I'm not sure. It's I don't know if you're on a headset or speakerphone.
Hello, can I sound better?
No, it's still a little bit of distortion. If you want to hang up and call back in, I can get you immediate.
I'll do that.
All righty. Well, while she's doing that, the caller at 3098, did you have a question for Professor Gordon?
I do. Good evening, everybody. Good evening, Gus. Good evening, listeners, participants. Good evening, Professor Gordon. Let me ask you, what do you expect the constructive effect that you hope to achieve with this, other than just writing about the academic effects of it? I'll ask that first. That's one question.
I mean, as any scholar writing about an issue of current importance, one hopes that their research will help to shape the law and help to shape policy going forward. You know, what I try and do in this book is show how destructive and how fundamentally racist the local organization of government in the St. Louis region has proven to be. And there are things that we can do about this in terms of making decisions at a different jurisdictional level of government, having much stronger civil rights and equity standards for the actions taken by local governments, for the actions taken by local school boards, that sort of thing.
All right, thank you. I want to go back to Gus's question about who you think the primary audience would be. You deferred on characterizing, I believe, at the University of Chicago, but you currently are tenured. Are you tenured at the University of Iowa?
Yes.
Okay. So would you characterize the University of Iowa as a predominantly white institution?
Oh, yes.
Okay. So in that characterization, would you extend the primary audience of your academics to be classified as white?
Not for this book. No, I don't teach this book on my own campus.
Okay. Thank you. One last question. Who is most confused by and or about the system of white supremacy, racism? And I will meet my line. Thank you.
I didn't understand that question.
You heard Gus's definition of white supremacy racism, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Now, in that definition, who would you say would have the least amount of understanding of how that system works and yes, who would have the most, the least amount of understanding of how that system works? White people or black people? Or white people or non-white people?
Again, I'm not sure that I have the expertise to answer that question. I think both whites and non-whites have pretty powerful understandings of the system in which they find themselves. Those understandings are different, but nevertheless, I don't think it's a matter that one understands less of the system than another, or more.
Well,
I would have to parse what you mean by understand. I mean, is it true that in the system of white supremacy that some whites are able to take it for granted, for example? That's not, I think, necessarily a lack of understanding.
Interesting. When I say understand, I guess like, okay, let me see if I can define understanding. If I say understanding, if I say to you that the system, understanding the power dynamic, how that works, would you agree? I don't want to assume anything. Would you agree that there is an unequal power dynamic between whites and blacks as the system of white supremacy as defined by Mr. Renegade?
Sure, certainly, yeah.
Now, if that is true, who is most ignorant of how this power dynamic is operating, whites or non-whites. Does that make it clearer?
Yeah, but I don't think I'm qualified to answer that question.
And why not? Why not? If I may, why not? I may ask, and that will be my last question, so I don't know time up alone. Thank you.
I mean, it's not my area of research. I'm trying to stay in my lane and speak about what I know. If you want to understand, you know, how and why people think of themselves and their position in a system of white supremacy, there are other scholars who study this problem and have studied this problem, and I'm not one of them.
All right. I'll see if our female caller was able to get back on the line. I did want to just make sure I heard one bit of information. When you were responding to our previous caller a few moments ago, and you said, you know, as a result of reading your book, that one should be able to ascertain that was it in St. Louis local government or which element of government is fundamentally racist as it relates to what you talk about in your book.
What I was alluding to there was the argument in the book that structuring government around this sort of these patchwork municipalities sustains and secures racism, which is not to say that racism is absent in larger jurisdictions of government, but the smaller units of government make it possible for people to act in exclusionary and racist manner. It empowers them to do so, to draw school district boundaries, to practice exclusionary zoning.
Got it. I just checked the same thing I've said all evening. I just checked. The word racist is only used in the actual text of your book twice, and neither time is it in reference to government. So people would have to imply that because that is not stated explicitly. And I am asserting strongly that that is one of the major problems. Going back to the obfuscation, we don't make it plain the crimes that white people commit and how they practice racism, white supremacy. It ends up being very much pussyfooted, to use Minister Malcolm X's word. His voice was heard at the top of the broadcast. Let's see. Did our female caller, let's see if we got her back without distortion. Let's try again, ma'am.
Hello.
Oh, sounding better this time. Let's try it.
Okay. Thank you so much for allowing me to call back in. Professor Gordon, as I was stating, I think, I don't know, this word terror and terrorism, I don't know if you're confused about it because you can't seem to answer questions about it. So I just wanted to go to a source, Merriam-Webster. Do you think that's a good source to use to find the meaning of words before I continue?
Sure.
Okay. But it's something we all can have access to. We all can read it, you know, and get the information. So it says the definition of terror, there are several, but they all involve basically one says a state of intense or overwhelming fear, violence, or the threat of violence used as a weapon of intimidation or coercion, especially violent or destructive acts, such as a bombing, committed by groups in order to intimidate a population or a government into granting their demands. A very frightening or terrifying aspect. I don't know if that's a good definition. And one, they call it informal and an extremely disruptive or annoying person or thing. Based on these definitions, can you explain in your book which experiences would not be terrorism? Because these are general definitions from Merriam-Webster.
Well, I mean, I think I already answered
no,
this question.
No, you didn't. Definitely ask it again. You didn't. You said you couldn't.
I do not describe the events that unfold in my book as terrorism.
I understand that, but would you consider them based on the definition that I gave? Was the acts be considered terrorism? I mean, threatening, saying you can't be part of the community unless we bring in police. I mean, that sounds like based on what I just read, personally to me, again, I'm not an academic. I don't have a doctorate degree like you, you know.
No, I would give the same answer I gave earlier, in that there are some elements and episodes in the book which meet your definition of terrorism.
Merriam-Webster, this is not mine. Merriam-Webster.
No, we're agreeing on that definition.
Okay.
That it's a reasonable definition.
But based on this definition, and knowing that, no, you're not an expert at everything, but you're expert enough to write the book that people are relying on, because you just said you are an expert witness, and I'm sure some of it is based on this book and this research that you have done, you're not able to do that? Is that what you're saying?
No, I actually think we agree. I did not use the word terrorism in the book, but I agree that many of the elements of my argument, many of the episodes and circumstances I've described, which are backed by the explicit or implicit threat of violence, do meet that definition of terrorism.
Okay, but there's a difference between many and all. So are all of them, is there one in particular that is not? Again, like you said, words are important. There's a difference between many and all.
I'm not prepared to describe every single thing that unfolded in the events that I talk about in the book as an act of terrorism. I think it's too sweeping a term.
What was the last definition from Merriam-Webster for terrorism that we all agreed that's an acceptable source for a definition? What was that last definition there?
The informal one?
Yes,
that they listed?
Yes, ma'am.
An extremely disruptive or annoying person or thing. That sounds pretty sweeping to me.
That's what I thought. Which component, if I just can echo her question again, which component from your book do you not think qualifies as disruptive or extremely annoying?
I don't know what you're asking me to speak to. Are you talking about one of the major themes of the book, like urban renewal or the drawing of municipal boundaries? Are you talking about a particular episode?
Oh, episodes. I'm sorry, episodes. Like Mr. Thornton episodes.
Yeah, I mean, I'll just repeat my answer. I'm not prepared to describe every single thing that happens in the course of this story as an act of terrorism. I think it's a misuse of the word. And I think if you use the word in that sweeping a manner, it loses meaning, and it loses meaning where it's important.
Well, I just thought that when I went back to read the book, I would be able to identify them and agree with you. But I guess I can't do that because it's too sweeping. Darn. Oh, well. But I did have another, a question about trust, because you said to read the book, you know, somebody asks if they can trust you, I'll just read the book. But, I mean, again, a definition, according to Merriam-Webster, assured relies on the character, ability, strength, or truth of someone or something. So one in which confidence is placed. And I'm guessing, because you said this book is geared towards a community, what do you expect the community to do? To just go, oh, that's a cute story? Wouldn't you expect them to act on what you've read if you've written for the community?
Yes, and in fact, I've been in a number of community meetings in St. Louis where we discussed this research and the research of others.
So trusting, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. Excuse me, I really didn't mean to do that. So trusting in your material is very important, yes?
Yes.
Okay. So when someone asks if they can trust you, because this is your material, and most academics, when they write in something, it's not something they read about for 20 minutes. They usually spend years and years in this information. Is that correct?
Yes.
So now I'm not saying I can't trust you to cook me food or anything like that, but in this particular matter, to help us understand the context of white supremacy, should we be able to trust you? based on the information that you've given us?
Based on the information in the book, yes.
Okay. Thank you. That's all I have. Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. And just with words, one thing I can do with Adobe, even though, like I said, my iBook and Kindle Reader, they work much more efficiently. I was able to go through and count the word racism, the word racist, terror, terrorism. All four of those terms combined total are used 3 times in the actual text of the book. The word terror is not used at all in the book. The word terrorism is not used at all in the book. And the word racism is used 1 time in the book.
That's not true. The word racism is used, I would guess, over 100 times in the book.
You are incorrect.
Wrong with your search engine.
Well, I'm going by the Adobe here, and it's racism is in the text, actual body of the text. I found it 1 time. It is in the, you know, references, footnotes, all of that. And I mean, I wasn't surprised. Even you saying hundreds, that would be, I strongly suspect that you're practicing white supremacy racism, because it stood out to me immediately. When I started reading your book, it's been some days ago. When I started reading your book some time ago, I think I got through about the first 25 pages. In a story like this, you started with Cookie Thornton. You got the outline of Michael Brown Jr. on the cover of the book. And with all of this, the word racism, I was not seeing it in the book. So I'm not surprised. Using the Adobe search 1 time in the actual body of the text, it's definitely not 100. And for you to even say, to put a number on it, I pay attention to that. When people, you could just say, I don't agree, I think it's in there a lot. To put a number on it 100 times, I strongly suspect you're practicing white supremacy racism, because race relations is used in this book way more than the term racism. Not to mention white supremacy is not used at all, but that's neither here nor there. I wanted to get back to the question was asked about white people, or who is more informed about racism, white supremacy. You making that outlandish statement, and I have to state that words are important. I thought about that. Outlandish to say racism is used in this book 100 times. It knocked me off of the page I was to get to my next question, which was about the who is more informed about white supremacy racism. And you have several passages in your book that I think get to this point in a very important manner. I want to read both of these because they're not very long. So the first, and I highlighted both of them. The first one, this is on page 2, very early in the book. You write, a revised plan called for staging redevelopment so that new homes on Elmwood Park's east side would be available before residents on the west side were faced with relocation. This is removal of the Negroes. But none of this happened. County officials used the idea of staged development to placate federal officials, but privately and in their communications with Elmwood Park residents, pressed public housing in St. Louis as the best option. For Esther Brooks, who had owned her own home in Elmwood Park for over 30 years, the option of taking an apartment in the city's notorious Pruitt-Igoe complex, there's a documentary about that place, far removed from family, friends, and her place of employment, was entirely obnoxious to her. That's one. And then this comes up again, the same idea. Let me see how quickly I can get through to the other highlight. This is on, all right, so one more. This one is a little bit further down in the book. This is, and talk about patterns. I think that's so important. I mentioned that earlier. So this is on page 101 of the book, about the halfway chunk of the text. You write, in its initial planning, the county did what it could. And I'll even pause right there. That's what I mean. There's a lot of minimizing. It's not the county. Like, the county doesn't do anything. It's white people. That's what I mean. That's another one that pointed out to me, where white people are not just being indicted explicitly. And this is a common pattern in how white people, when they write about these type of events, the county, just sit and think about that. I mean, man, I got to remind me to tell you about King County, Washington, before the program ends. That's so important. But King County, Washington, does not do anything to me. It would be white people in whatever position of power that they have in King County government. That would be what it is. Not King County did this, or St. Louis County did this. In its initial planning, the county, white people, did what it could to placate federal officials with the promise of staged redevelopment while sticking to its original assumption that most of the Elmwood Park families would never return. But even on this score, its efforts were patently insincere. Started the program. Woo! The LCRA argued publicly that displaced families had many options, but admitted privately that such options were limited. Just those two patterns right there, because that pops up repeatedly, that pattern in the book, unless I'm lying. That right there to me suggests that whites are more informed about racism, because they're having private conversations where they already know what's going to happen. These Negroes are not coming back. And more importantly, we know where they're going. They don't know that. And we're even telling them false information, obfuscating. We're coming out publicly and saying one thing, and we already know that's not what's going to happen. That right there means that you are more informed about this process because you are spreading disinformation. Isn't that correct, Professor Gordon?
No, I don't think it's correct.
What's incorrect about
that? The residents of Elmwood Park were fully aware of what was going on as well. They understood exactly what was happening to them. So I don't think that one in that one narrow episode that you're talking about, mm-hmm. which is the way in which the white citizens in the county communicated the relocation options to the black residents of Elmwood Park, mm-hmm. I think both understood exactly what was going on.
Well, that's your view. I have always taken the position that people that have plans and you show where they have maps about redevelopment, generally speaking, I take the view, just trying to follow logic, the people that have the plans about what they want this place to look like 5 years down the road, 10 years down the road, those people are more informed than the people that do not have those plans and are the targets of those plans and what's going to happen. But I have frequently been told that people do not agree with that assessment. You have to come to your own conclusions. Person that dialed in from a blocked number. Did you have a question for Professor Colin Gordon?
Yes, I did. Good, Gus, and greetings to all the callers and listeners on the line. Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Greetings, Professor. Is it Professor Gordon?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, okay. A caller asked you, I believe he asked you, what was your constructive intent with writing this book? And you started with, you started your answer saying, you know, like most scholars, I want to do et cetera and et cetera. Correct? That's how you started, correct?
Yep, fair enough.
Okay, that word fair. But yet, when Gus asked you if you thought, based on your research, based on your experience as a white person, whites are often sincerely and greatly pained by racism, you said that you could not speak for them because you weren't in any position to do that. You weren't an expert, you weren't qualified to speak on that, but yet you were qualified to speak on other scholars because you are one, and you know, based on your experience and things of that nature. So my question is this: why were you able to speak on one group of people and you weren't able to speak on the other?
I have a particular area of expertise that is based on doing archival research in local history to uncover the mechanisms of segregation. To the degree that that illuminates what the motives of and the impacts of those policies were at the time, I feel qualified to make assessments. But as for the, you know, the sort of larger question about that you suggested, does not lie in my area of academic expertise, and I'm not going to spitball a response.
Sir, I don't know what spitball means, but I'll also say what you just said is not true at all, because what I just spoke about didn't have anything to do with any specific, I guess you could say, subcategory of expertise. You spoke for scholars in general. You didn't speak for scholars in a particular area or any of that.
No, I'm not speaking. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, go ahead. You're not speaking.
No, I am talking on this program, responding to callers based on my research into the causes and consequences of highly racialized public policies in the suburbs of St. Louis. And that's what I'm prepared to talk about. I don't have the training or the expertise to speak to other questions.
Sir, but you did that. You spoke to you spoke on scholars in general. You said like most scholars, but you couldn't speak on, you know, whites, given that, you know, you're one of them. Just basically asking based on, you know, your experience and the white people that you're around and things of that nature. But you were able to do that just based on being a scholar and speaking about most scholars based on, I guess, the scholars that you're around and just you being one in general. I'll just say this in close. The point is, you said like most scholars. You spoke on most scholars and you generalized in that way. But you wouldn't do that when it came to the specific question that Gus asked you. And I think, you know, if anyone goes back and listens to this broadcast, they can the deception that you practiced in that contradiction is very apparent. And that was it. I'll mute my line. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Gus.
I'm not practicing deception. I will generalize about the work of other scholars that I know. I'm happy to sort of, for example, talk about the St. Louis experience against the experience of other cities, because in order to make sense of St. Louis, I've read the work of scholars on other cities. But none of that qualifies me to answer, you know, the large question about, you know, what most whites believe, or as you put it, I think, Gus, you know, the who knows more in a given circumstance. It's not the way I approach things, and it's not, again, an area in which I feel qualified to speak.
Context of white supremacy. University of Iowa's History Department Professor Colin Gordon. We've been discussing his book, Citizen Brown. I said those metaphors. He said, spitball, a response. I said, wow, look at that. And then he has an article, Professor Gordon, that's also about Ferguson, Making Ferguson, Segregation and Uneven Development in St. Louis and St. Louis County in Ferguson's Fault Lines, The Race Quake That Rocked the Nation. Even that last one, The Race Quake. Don't even know what that is. And I'd never heard that one either. Spitball or response. That is a new one. I wanted to
give Gus, I have one more question.
Thomas in New York, let's hear your question.
Oh, thank you very much. And thank you, sir, for your time this evening. I have one more question for you, and I'm not asking you for your scholarly expertise, just your personal honesty. It's a yes or no question, if you could just elaborate. Do you think we would have a system of racism, white supremacy, if the end product of sexual relations between blacks and whites was a white child and not a black child?
I have no idea.
I have a question, Gus.
Hang on one second. I didn't see we had folks that we missed totally. Imhan DC, did you have a question for Professor Gordon?
Yes, sir. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Thank you. My question is, I had just a few questions. My first question is, where are white people indigenous to? where are white people indigenous to?
I'm not an anthropologist.
Not an anthropologist. I guess that's his response. Did you have more with that question or another question, Imhan DC?
Oh, that throws me off quite a whole lot, because I don't know if I should ask another question. I had a question to go with that, and my next. Do I have another question? Will he give me the definition of white supremacy?
Whose definition?
Okay, I didn't know if you were on the line. I wasn't speaking to Gus for the definition. I was actually asking for your definition. Of white supremacy?
I mean, I would, first of all, I'll reiterate, I'm a scholar of a particular kind of setting, so I can only define, my working definition of white supremacy would be, as I see it in my own work, but it would be a systematic pattern of racial stratification, racial inequality, and racial oppression across, all realms of human endeavor, from, education to housing to employment. That would be my working definition.
Can any person be a white supremacist? I think by your definition, you didn't explain which person is a white supremacist, which isn't, like in the definition, who actually does these actions that you're referring to?
White people.
Yes, sir. So can I ask my first question? Where are white people indigenous to? Yes, where are white people indigenous
to? I don't know the answer to the question because I don't have that expertise. I mean, you'd have to ask an anthropologist who, understands, large pan-historical demographic patterns.
Really? Okay. Well, are white people indigenous to America?
No.
Okay, the Black Americans, are they indigenous to America?
No.
Okay. Who is indigenous to America?
Native Americans.
Okay. Maybe I'm not using the right words. I thought Native American and Indigenous American was the same thing.
It is.
But a Black person, we know what that is because I can say Black person, and then we're speaking about the color brown, and then we can say white person, and we're speaking about the color peach or some color like that. But we say indigenous, or we say Native American, and I don't know who you're talking about. But you said you don't know what white people are indigenous to. You do know that Black people are not indigenous to America. But who are Native Americans? Maybe I don't have all my questions to ask, or maybe you're answering the questions in such a way that you're being confusing?
Neither those that we conventionally call white or those that we call Black or African American are indigenous to North America. Native Americans or indigenous Americans are. But I think we agree on that. I'm just not sure what the question is that you're asking.
that follows from that?
I thought that black people were indigenous to America. I thought the Native Americans, the indigenous Americans, were black people, unless they were another color that you could tell me about. I know that they're not white people. But then my question would have been, well, then if white people are over here and they're not indigenous to this place, to America, but they control America, then my question would be, is this a hegemony? Is that the word? How you say the word? Hegemony? Would you call what white people are doing controlling an area that they're not from, and controlling the people that are in that area? Do you call that a hegemony or a hegemony? If I'm saying the word right.
You could use that word. I mean, I think I would call it colonialism or settler colonialism.
Terrorism.
Okay, well, those were my questions. Again, I really would like to know where white people are indigenous from, and you're a white person. So, but I'd like to know that. But thank you.
Right on. Retired firefighter, a last question for Professor Gordon.
Yes, I would like to know the guest's answer to the problem. How can this problem be solved?
Solved is a pretty weighty word. I think, you know, what my research suggests is that there are a number of things that we could do as a community in St. Louis to alleviate some of these problems. That doesn't solve them. I don't pretend that it does.
Do you have an answer?
I can answer the question the way I rephrased it, which is.
Well, I would just like to know what your answer is, what your personal answer is to the problem.
What my book points to as constructive avenues of policy would be breaking down municipal boundaries, equalizing funding across school districts and municipalities, consolidating the fragmented and sort of deeply racist municipal court system in St. Louis, and pursuing locally, state level, or nationally some sort of system of reparations that can reverse the generational damage that's been done to African-American opportunity and African-American wealth by all of these racial housing and property policies.
Well, I think you're speaking of a local situation, but the host asked you very early in the program. Well, he didn't ask you. He gave his meaning to the global system of racism, white supremacy, and you agreed with it, I believe. And to that, I would like for you to give us your answer to that problem, not just the problem.
I don't have an answer.
Okay.
Right on.
Not what I studied.
Not what he studies. All right.
You don't have to speak any further on it.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. One thing that you do study is Citizen Brown, Race, Democracy, and Inequality in the St. Louis Suburbs. Now, Professor Gordon asserted arrogant expertise on how many times the word racism is in his book. He had the audacity to put a number on it, 100, and claimed expertise about the piece of technology I'm using to say that there was something faulty with either the software, my computer, what have you, with what I'm using. That is going to have to be verified. So you are going to have to go on your device at some point and check and give an account of how many times the word racism, and I'll even, you can add racist, add both of them and see if they are in the body of the work, not references from a book somebody else wrote that has racism in the title or something, but actually in the body of your work, Citizen Brown, is the word racism used? One, I said it's in there once, so we're not close. Wide chasm, wealth gap, racial gap, there it is. You said it was in there 100 times. I'm saying it's in there one time. And if we add racist, three combined, three uses, that I'm saying it is a major act of white supremacy on your part. In fact, I'm saying it's deliberate. And I need that verified. So if you have a perfectly working computer, Kindle, mobile device that you think is working in tip-top shape, let's get that verified immediately. How many times is the word racism used in Citizen Brown? Are you checking? Are you getting your device, Professor Gordon? Waiting for the verification. Are you checking that out for us? Hopefully he is on the iPhone or sitting down at the computer to get verification. How many times is the word racism in the actual body of the text? Again, not the references, not the title to someone else's text, your work. How many times is the word racism in the book? We'll be here tomorrow, book club. I hope, Professor Gordon, I hope you are checking and will let us know once you've done a search and can verify how many times it's in the book. If this is one of those where you're not going to respond, I would appreciate you being able to at least say that so we're not just wasting time on the air, because this is important. We've been saying that all night. Words are important, and this one especially, since there's such, you know, disagreement. This is not, we're close, metaphorically, we're not splitting hairs. I'm saying racism is in the book one time, and you're saying it's in there 100 times. Well, let's find out. So I hope you are looking and not wasting our time. Well, I will make sure that I am using the time while we wait for Professor Gordon to give us the tally of how many times racism is in the book. Should be easy. You should be able to pull it up. You should have a perfectly working device where you can pull it up and tell us how many times it's in the book accurately. But we will be here tomorrow for our book. Oh, do we have a number? Let's get it. Let's get it.
No, I think that was me.
Oh. I was excited, like, let's hear it. Let's hear it. My machine is not working correctly. I would like to know that, too, because that would be quality information, because I do this on the book club tomorrow all the time. It's important when you're reading books that are about white supremacy or racism, or at least that seems to be what they're talking about, but the word racism doesn't get used in the book. They end up using words like microaggressions, white privilege, discrimination, race relations. I talked about that in James. That's another one where he didn't use the word terrorism. He didn't use the word terror, but he used the word race relations like 100 times. Professor Gordon, it looks like his line dropped, so he hung up. I just tweeted, that is a major act of white supremacy. We had a white man whose book is trash, by the way, that's why I didn't say read it. We had a white man who had the audacity to say so many times, oh, I'm not an expert. I'm not even an expert on white people. Just said, oh, yeah, I'm a white man. But I'm not even an expert on white people. I can't even do that. But he had expertise not just on how many times the word racism was in a book he wrote, to say that I was wrong, way wrong. I say it's in there one time. You say it's in there 100 times. And then your equipment is not working correctly. You have expertise even on the computer that I'm using. Whew. I feel so vindicated. So vindicated when we are on the book club and I do my word count. Anybody that's on the book club who has heard me when I go through and say, oh, the word terrorism in this book one time, the word race relations. Has anybody heard me do my word count when I do the book club at all?
Yes, sir.
Yes.
Words are hugely important. I think Anthony Browder was on the program, and I think some other, it's not just one person, he's just what I'm thinking of. They were talking about the difference when you read like a hard copy of a book and you can actually put your hand on the pages and turn and read them, and how that stimulates a different part of your brain. Absolutely. That is 1,000% correct, and I totally agree. But I can't do the word count when I read a hard copy book. That is one. There are several things, but that is one thing in particular that I love about ebooks, because sometimes patterns, words are so important, and repetitive word use is extremely important. So you just keep saying white privilege, discrimination, microaggression. That just becomes the way to talk about racism. And that was a point I wanted to make sometime. Or, man, when we say it is about white supremacy, racism above all, that means sometimes you are not writing a book to make $1 million. This is not going to be a Harry Potter series. This is not 50 Shades of Grey. This is about white supremacy, racism. It could end up being where a book like Citizen Brown, he was just on St. Louis Public Radio with black people, no less, who did not question him, ask him if he was racist, ask him if he heard any racist jokes. But this will end up, could very easily end up being the book that your child, if they have to do a report on what happened in Ferguson, this will be the book that they read, Citizen Brown. This will be the lens and how you interpret that event in a book where the word racism is not used 100 times. The word racism is in there one time. That is hugely important. When I say words, just being mindful about it. I knew this book was, I was so not even motivated about the program today. It was terrible, even though it was a very sunny, beautiful day in Seattle. I got to do yoga, and I was still, ugly day all day long. And made even more so, I've been reading this book for days and knew it was trash. I just told you, I've been reading this book. I tell people all the time, prepping for these programs, reading is more important than watching television. I love reading the books of white people because you really get to study and understand racism, white supremacy, and how they think just with the words that they use or the words that they don't use. You're talking about all this and not saying racism. You're talking about all this and not saying white supremacy, but you will say race relations, some tacky phrasing like that. You're not even indicting white people. The paragraph that I read where you're saying the county did this to the Negroes of St. Louis. What kind of nonsense is that? And I know for some people, they, you know, might hear that and say, oh, you're just, you know, going for nonsense. You don't have to say white people every time, or this is a scholarly. If it's scholarly, it should be even more attentive to detail. It shouldn't be a scholar at a major university who comes out and says the word racism is in my book 100 times and it's in there once. All I can conclude is that you are very sloppy with your scholarship, or you're practicing racism, white supremacy. And I'm going to take the latter. That was following logic. I'm going to take the latter because there's so much detail in the book. There's so many references in the book. He sent me several e-versions of the book with the details. He does not strike me as someone who performs in a sloppy manner. And certainly to be a tenured university professor, you don't get to be sloppy, but you do get to support the system of white supremacy, racism. Words are super. I can't believe it, but on words. How many times is the word racism in your book? And that's where you hang up the phone. That is the tackiness and commitment, dedication to white supremacy, racism. No obfuscation right there at all. Let's see. Retired.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. It's a pattern that I notice. A lot of white people of his background, scholars, quote unquote, and I think he even used the word expertise when it comes to racist white supremacy, at least in some segment. They do not want to answer or speak on the issue from a personal standpoint, as though there's some sort of disconnect between what a white person writes about or talk about and what they think personally. And I find that also as a consistent practice of racism and white supremacy when they do so. That plays a large part in when I was asking him a question about, you know, can he be trusted? I mean, he should be willing to answer that question, whether it is on the cows, or if I was a student at Iowa State University and he was having a lecture and I asked him that question. He should be willing to answer that question. That is vital. And I don't think I have to explain that on this program on why that's vital. Certainly a white person of his magnitude that he pertains to be should be willing to answer such a basic question. And he didn't even have an answer to the problem that he is writing about. You know, so what's the relevancy of him? You know, that puts weight on trust if he don't even have an answer to the problem that he's talking about. You know, and so, yeah, those are my thoughts. Last but not least, I would be willing to read live, because right now I don't really for sure know how to utilize the recording. But I'd be willing to read live if it's okay.
Much obliged for the effort, dear sir. I do try to avoid the live reads just because I don't know about you, but I know I suspect even the professional narrators generally might need a take or two, you know, with the pronunciation sometimes, or reading a book for the first time, or at least they prep in advance. I suspect you have to be really, really skilled and with some practice to do it, you know, live without any, whoops, let me get that sentence again type thing. So we will try to see if we can find a person who can do us for this week solid, and then can pick up next week, hopefully after you are back safe and sound in Florida. But thank you for the offer. Hopefully we won't have to do that for Gerald Horn. His biography on Paul Robeson, book club. Reading is more important than watching television. I do have the ebook for that one, so I can boop, 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 go through and do the word search and all that, which I do think can be very informative, very helpful. Did other folks have a question, comment, what they heard from Professor Colin Gordon? Highly suspected. Ray, he is just with the number of times racism is in the book, for him to say it's in there 100 times, for that alone, he is not trustworthy, because it is not in, not even close, unless, you know, my equipment is very, very faulty.
And local. Go ahead, ma'am.
No, you can finish your comment. I can wait. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, because the people like himself, quote unquote scholars, they have a practice of limiting the global system of racist white supremacy, and it's interconnected. It's an extension. So if he is so much of an expert on what he writes about, then he should be able to apply that extensively to the global system. And, you know, for him not to answer that question is paramount, you know, even for a non-white person to have at least an opinion, you know, but a white person, they should be coming with some answers. That's it.
The female caller.
Hi, I just want to thank you again for the program. I think it's instructive. I know sometimes, you know, even if we read a book that we don't like, I think it's constructive, like you said, to find out what people are thinking. So I just want you to, well, I want you to be encouraged by that. I know it's not always a good feeling, but, you know, it is constructive because you are actually trying to solve the problem. And I think this man, I know he's supposed to be a scholar, but I think he's crazy. According to Merriam-Webster, full of cracks or flaws or not mentally sound, marked by thought or action that lacks reason. If you're a scholar, it seems like some of those things he should have been able to answer. So according to Merriam-Webster, he might be crazy.
I do know Dr. Francis Cress-Welsing did caution on the cow specifically. I believe it was spring 2012 at the very start of the program about describing whites as being crazy and saying that frequently what we are observing is someone doing exactly what they intended to do, which is practice white supremacy racism, which, you know, it may look quote unquote crazy because it is not logical to harm someone just because they have darker complexion. But if that's what that person wants to do and they set about the business of doing that, and that includes lying or not answering questions or using confusing terms, that's just practicing racism, white supremacy. And I think that's,
well, they could be, I'm sorry, but they could be equivalent in this case that he was acting crazy to confuse us. They could be equivalent in case.
Well, I would. That's a different way of stating it. If someone is behaving in a irrational manner to cause confusion, that's especially if someone classified as white is doing that. Then, yeah, I would state it that way, and that would be stated as an act of racism. This person is behaving in a delusional manner to try to confuse us. Act of racism. That's the way I would articulate it, because sometimes that word crazy can absolve people of guilt and intentionality.
Sounds like the way to describe Donald Trump.
Right. Right. Right.
Ready here?
Yes, ma'am. Ivy.
Man, it was just, I don't know, it was so obvious to me when he just was starting to be deceptive and intentionally vague, and when he was pretty much just going down the road of, you know, refusing to answer certain questions, he was really getting a feel for your lesser confusion, that you are, you know, less confused, and the things that you said when you mentioned about, you know, white power and things of that nature. And, you know, he's a person who's deliberately, who's deceptive, because I think deception and being, you know, deliberate about it is pretty much, that's redundant. But he's, you know, he's deceptive just even using the word, you know, privilege and things of that nature. He's one of those white people who, you know, want to minimize racism. And I just think that he was just, certainly purposely not answering questions, and you could just kind of, you could see it. And I, to catch him in just the generalization of scholars, that's why I'm glad somebody asked him that question in terms of what was his motive, that he was willing to speak on, you know, what most scholars' intentions are, but he wasn't willing to speak on, you know, how most white people feel in his experience. About racism, whether or not they're greatly pained and things of that nature. I had a question, Gus. Did he agree with your definition of racism, or did he take any issue with the term dedicated or any of that?
He said he thought that it was accurate, the definition And then he quickly pivoted to his own work being about local issues and not, you know, that broad or something on a global scale or whatever. But his work being about global affairs in the Missouri area. But before all of that, he did say that he thought it was an accurate definition.
Oh, okay, thank you. And I actually thought he was going to hang up, and I thought, you know, he was getting more and more, I guess, uncomfortable with the, I guess, the focused, for lack of words, the focused questioning and the directness. Just you saying that you thought he was practicing racism. I said that he was being deceptive. The things that the brilliant female caller said to him tonight when she pulled out the Merriam-Webster dictionary. And I knew, I knew things were going to get so rough when MIDC was going to talk to him. Like, I was like, oh, man, he's in for it. But, yeah, I kind of figured, I'm surprised he stayed on as long as he did. I figured that that he would hang up and he would bail out. That was it. I'll mute my line. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Gus.
Mm-hmm. Definitions, so important. And I thought that was important as well, that he was so staunch that I am not going to say that every aspect of this is terrorism. Well, which parts are excluded? Which parts do you think don't qualify? Well, you know, can't, like, if you're so strong, like, there should be at least one component that you can pick out, like what they did with the school system, the policing, the housing, not employing black businesses, some aspect of this that you could point out and say, okay, well, this right here, the racist email, something. I don't really know if that qualifies as terrorism. Yeah, it's incorrect, but that's not necessarily terrorism. And he couldn't even pick out one component, especially when it gets to. So the definition for terrorism: annoying, disruptive, and extremely annoying. Which component of this is not disruptive and extremely annoying? That's what I mean. Like, when you have a definitions are crucial. And that's when you can see the insincerity of whites, in my view, their commitment to racism, white supremacy. But I thought that was so important, as well as his responses to the questions in general. Not accustomed to being questioned with suspicion, which I think is the case for most whites. Did other folks?
Hello.
Yes,
can
ma'am.
I be heard?
We'll get our female.
I'm sorry,
Go ahead.
I had to cut you off again, but when I started listening to the program, I started listening in the TuneIn app, and I heard you, and I didn't hear him. Because you were like, who is he talking to? Because I can't hear them. So I started listening over the phone, so you might want to just check that when you go back and review. I just wanted to bring that up. Thank you.
Oh, much obliged. I think it was not the audio from the program line was not on the tune in for a bit, but I think I caught that a little bit in. But yeah, I think I did see that it seemed like it wasn't going out. So corrected that. It should be working now if folks want to listen on tune in or where it should have been working there for a while now. If that was it from the female caller, much obliged. The male caller, thank you for your patience, sir.
I thought it was pretty interesting how you kind of caught him up when B in Toronto asked him about if he got any money from the book sales, and he said no. But then you followed up with a question about his appearances, and I guess he admitted that he had got some money for the appearances. I don't think he said how much, but I'm assuming, you know, he probably got Jane Elliott, Tim Wise money, you know, $12,000 appearance, you know. So I thought that was pretty interesting. And that's how I'm in my line.
It's so easy for whites to, you know, be compensated for that sort of thing. That I should have asked that, or one of us, you know, should have, that was my question. I should have asked that, how much he got for those engagements. But it's so easy for them to be called. And as I said, equally or more important, really, this becomes the scholarship. This is like a valid interpretation of racism in Ferguson in a book that only has racism in it one time. This is very common. How him saying the entire time on the, or so consistently that, oh, I'm not an expert. I'm on an expert. And I'm going to be an expert witness, but I'm not an expert. I can't tell you about white people. This will end up becoming the expert guide to understanding racism, or it'll be race relations in Ferguson. And I think that he understands, white people understand the power of, so that's how you end up with something like a broken windows policy from someone like him at an academy or a university where maybe you don't get, you know, $5 million in a New York Times bestseller for the book, because I think he said it was supposed to be free, freely available. But it ends up having a huge impact with regards to refining, expanding the practice of racism, white supremacy, and how even racism, white supremacy is talked about. All very important. Were there other folks who had questions, comments?
Yes, my observation is on how precise that white people are in their codified racist understandings and articulations. I've been participating on your program almost, if not all, of the 10 years, and they are quite consistent. Now, mind you, all of these white people perceivably are strangers, but yet but you know, by us being on this program for so long, we can see a consistency out of these people who are normally are total strangers to each other. And, you know, if anybody would want to know on how the global system of racism is practiced and why it's so, it dominates people who they consider not to be white, it certainly can be observed on this program, on how consistent they are and how concise they are in their codification, their racist codification. Thank you.
Absolutely. That is no patterns. We talked about that. That is no accident. The obfuscating, the words that they use, which questions they kind of back away from, all of that is very important. Just being able to see those patterns. I was teaching yoga in the park this summer. A Cal's listener was present. And she said, you know, you have to have more white guests on the program. That is important. Opportunities to question white people and just to observe patterns, to learn what it means to be white is important. I think that's the thing that we don't do enough of, questioning white people. It's studying, questioning and studying whites. Super important. Were there other folks who, B in Toronto, did you have commentary to share?
Yes, thank you, Gus, and hello to callers and listeners. It was just, I just noticed that Professor Gordon just seemed to answer right on his code. Whenever he felt that it was going away from what he was willing to answer, I guess in his own way, trying to control and dominate the conversation by controlling what he will answer to and what he will not. You know, he'll say that he's staying in his lane, which I was curious. If he had stayed on, I would have been curious enough to ask, how do you mean? It was just an interesting slang that he kept using, things of that nature. So yeah, it was quite interesting. Thank you, and leave the line.
Much obliged, be in Toronto. Yeah, that was interesting use of slang, stay in my lane. Were there other folks who had questions, comments they wanted to share?
I think he was lying about not getting paid off the book. I mean, obviously you exposed him in terms of the speaking engagements, but I mean, just to even direct sales of the book or whatever it was that he said we don't get paid for, I think he was lying about that. Because I think, as I said earlier, very early on when he, you know, realized what he was dealing with, he decided he was going to stop asking certain questions. He was going to answer them in a certain way. And I think the way that, you know, I believe it was Dean Toronto, forgive me if I'm getting that wrong, who said to him about, you know, getting paid off of black people, just even the way she put it, it was her, right? Yes?
Yes, ma'am, I believe so.
Oh, and she's on the line. Okay, so yeah. Just even the way she put it, like, I think that, you know, he decided, you know, he was gonna lie about that. I just say I don't believe him. That was it.
I've said that repeatedly. I think white people, they understand very early on when they are around non-white people who are less confused. So, yeah. Yeah. Any other questions, comments, observations? Book club is tomorrow. Gerald Horn. Biography on Paul Robeson. It is not very long. If we have any folks who would like to do the first little bit of narrating, just reading that bit, getting it recorded, and all set for tomorrow, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, just drop me an email, and if I can get the recording sometime tomorrow, well before the program, that would be grand. Let's see. Oh, Workplace Racism, Friday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. We'll be looking forward to sharing, hopefully, some constructive suggestions on how to solve these type of problems. 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, and compensatory call-in on Saturday, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. Let's see. I did not enjoy reading this book. I cannot emphasize that enough. I included the segment from Minister Malcolm X because I thought that was important, him talking about you don't have second-class citizens. You're either a citizen or you're a slave. System of racism, white supremacy is terrorism. It's slavery. You just have, you know, different phases of slavery. And I thought that was so important. And it's in his book so much. He says uneven citizenship. That's what black people have. And second class citizenship. And again, I just think all of that is deliberately vague, deliberately ambiguous in terms of understanding. And that's the way that people will talk. They'll just go around and say, yeah, you know, we're second class citizens. And why you want to be more direct about what the problem is. System of racism, white supremacy. That is the problem. Not second class citizenship, not uneven citizenship, not fragmented segment. And global. That's the other thing. When you're saying citizen, as though the problem is just located to this particular geographic location, and that is not what we're talking about at all.
Excuse me.
Do you have a comment, question?
No, I do not. Thank you. Okay.
Everybody,
I'm sorry.
Yes, ma'am.
I thought that was a great question about, you know, why he has, I guess I want to say the chalk outline or the outline or something like that of Michael Brown Jr.'s body, like on the cover of his book. I forgot what he said, but I wanted to know. First of all, do you believe, you know, the answer that he gave in terms of his motive for that? And if not, what do you think was the reason that he had that on the cover?
I don't. I mean, again, we could just go back to that word count. That's where he left at. He said it's in there 100 times, and I say it's in there one time. Now, if you're going to have that on the cover, I am going to elaborate, but I could just pose the question. If you're going to have a book with a chalk outline of Michael Brown Jr.'s body on the cover of your book and call the book Citizen Brown after Michael Brown Jr. and then have racism in the book one time, that word in the book one time. Is that adequate?
if that's going to be the representation on the front cover. Racism being in the book one time, do I think that this is going to do an adequate job with the subject matter? My conclusion to that, or my answer to that question, is emphatic. No. And that's what I felt every agonizing sentence, syllable of this book. I think that right there is the Delectable Negro. That is Black Miss Andry. That is total exactly what Dr. Curry talks about in The Man Knot, consumption of Black courses. That's how we understand Black people. Death. Even Cokie Thornton, the example he started with at the beginning of the book, this is a dead Black male. He does go in and do some shooting. I do think that's important because there are a number of Black people who have resorted to counter violence. I think that's a point I try to make regularly because, as he said, that story didn't get a lot of attention. We love to parade Black corpses out and look at the nigger that we killed here and strangled here and shot 50 times here. Love that. Put that out front and center. We'll probably have 50 documentaries about him and his corpse. That is a core aspect of white supremacy. Necrophilia has been a key concept on this broadcast for a decade. That's what I thought, particularly as I read the book and just how dishonest and it has a lot of details, but it's exactly what you heard on the program tonight. It's obfuscating. It's not being explicit about racism, white supremacy, because racism is only in the book once and white supremacy is not there at all. But yeah, I did think that that was very significant and in poor taste. I wish I had asked, like, if his family, like, if they knew or approved, like, that he'd get their permission to do this. Like, yeah, I mean, like, again, to have a white person to write this type of book, maybe if he had written a book, or yeah, you can judge by his conduct this evening, or if you want to agonize through the book, either or, is that deserving of, you know, this is a fitting way to honor the memory of Michael Brown Jr. from a white man? Another question I can conclude there.
Okay, thank you.
Well, if everybody is set for their Wednesday evening, we will call it a broadcast and resume tomorrow with the book club. Again, you can drop me an email if you have spare time, need something to do with your time and energy. You can narrate the first leg of Gerald Horn's biography on Paul Robeson. Should be available, I think, newer book, easily. We'll be ready to roll for tomorrow, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Retired firefighter will be able to help out down the road. Much obliged for everyone's participation. I told you King County is named after Dr. Martin Luther King. That's another, in my view, act of racism by white people, because Dr. Martin Luther King, unless I've been misinformed, he never came to Seattle, Washington to give a speech, talk, protest, nothing that I found that he ever hung out here. But it's King County. And so they have his picture all over the place on thing, anything that would have the county logo on it. Boop, they'll have his face plastered. So I see one of the buses go by, the city buses go by today, and it has this big sign up on the window. And it has, of course, King County bus. It's got Dr. King. And it says, I am in support, or I am in favor of inclusion and diversity. And it had the big picture of Dr. King. And I was stunned because I said, what is this, like, supposed to be like a thought bubble thing of Dr. King saying that he's about inclusion and diversity? I mean, that could be the same type of thing to take a Black person who was a victim of white supremacy and killed and then to plaster their image up in, you know, association, whatever. But I mean, it just stood out to me as really tacky. But I did see that today. King County, that is where Seattle is in Washington State. King County. The other point, I do think that's why I think it's so crucial to have to question whites and have whites on this program, because we don't do that very often, questioning white and questioning them with suspicion, not cursing them out and just being, you know, courteous, methodical, trying to resemble the grandsister, Dr. Welsing. But I think it's important we ask a question. If they, you know, try to throw it back or anything where they're playing like they don't understand, I would try as best I can to only restate the question and to not add a lot of talking. I think when the question was asked, because I thought it was crucial, I think when retired firefighter, when you asked him, you know, should I trust you? And he says, and he responded, he got so defensive. He says, should you not read my book? Do you think I lied in the book? Should you not listen to me? And I was like, wow, he didn't even say all of that. But that is interesting that you would jump to all of those conclusions immediately. And I think retired firefighter, you responded and you were saying, you know, well, being as a white person and all of this. And I just like, well, I think the question was simply, should I trust you? That was all. So all that, like, that would just be it. Like, I wouldn't try to say a whole lot. Just ask the question again and try to add as little as possible in terms of explanation. Like, I think that can be helpful a lot of times. I think Mr. Fuller says that by not helping them answer the question, that's something I try to improve on myself. But like I said, though, his response was, it was significant. The media should, you know, do you think I lied in the book? Should you not listen to me? Like, wow, that is, wasn't even saying all of that. But
sometimes the retired firefighter doesn't know when to shut up. So,
hey, we are all still learning.
Yes, sir.
Still learning. But we will try to do a bit more learning tomorrow. Same time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Gerald Horn, biography on Paul Robeson. Good person to learn a bit more about. And from a black author, no less. So I don't think we'll have. I think racism might be in his book a little bit more. I'll be able to check and verify for sure. Words are crucial. Man, words are crucial. Said that so many times. Obfuscate is one of my favorite words. I'm so glad that it was part of the theme for this evening's broadcast. Obfuscate. One you can add to your lexicon. See if you can get white people will give you many opportunities to use the word obfuscate. Anywho, yoga retreat will be in Florida December 28th to January 1. Counter racism, vegan meals, workshops on preparing meals and counter racism. Looking forward, 5 days, 4 nights. Lodging included, Chef Nadira doing counter-racist meals for the whole time that we are there. Deposit of $380 U.S. Due tomorrow. We were to get the price down to $730 by getting better lodging, so we don't have to spend so much for that. The final portion of the fee, which is $350, is due the second week of December. Tomorrow for deposits. Drop an email if you have questions, need additional information. Looking forward to hanging out in Florida with folks to start the new year in a constructive manner, hopefully with some delicious victuals to boot. With that, much obliged for everyone participating. Hope it was worthy of your time and energy. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy racism. Let's do all to keep, keep our brain computers working in an optimal manner so that we can solve the problem, certainly not depending on the likes of Professor Gordon. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled up every time we are in a vehicle, passenger or driver. That was one of the things that they were terrorizing black citizens in St. Louis and beyond for, seat belt. Violations. Just trying to minimize that as much as we can. In addition to being buckled up and sober, not being on the cell phone if you are driving. That's another one. another one of those little tacky violations. Just trying to minimize the contact with the Darren Wilsons, Amber Geigers of the known universe. With that, creator, it has been time. Replace the system of white supremacy with justice as soon as possible. Help us to be patient with other black people and ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact
with another black person. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Thanks so much for tuning in. Cows, signing out.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.